From Sarasota Memorial and the Deb Cabanoff Multimedia Studio, this is HealthCast, a healthy dose of information from experts you can trust.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to HealthCast. I'm Allison Gottermeyer. Thank you so much for joining us today as we talk about common gastrointestinal concerns and their treatments. Our guest today is Dr. Mark Radetich, a gastroenterologist with First Physicians Group here at Sarasota Memorial. Dr. Radetich, thank you so much for joining us.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
What are some of the most common GI issues that you see daily?
So gastroesophageal reflux disease, difficulty swallowing, abdominal pain, issues with gallstones and kind of gallstone-associated problems, pancreatic problems, and a lot of times issues with bowel habits, people who have issues with kind of chronic diarrhea, chronic constipation, irritable bowel syndrome, or inflammatory bowel disease are probably some of the more common things we see in gastroenterology.
We're going to break down some of those things today. So how can you tell the difference between normal digestive discomfort and an issue that actually requires seeing a gastroenterologist like yourself?
Sure. So I think the big thing there is chronicity and severity of symptoms. So symptoms that are very kind of mild in nature, or symptoms that tend to be kind of intermittent or go away after a short period of time are usually not serious. Those oftentimes are occur as a result of either dietary changes, lifestyle changes, or stressors in one's life. On the other hand, symptoms that tend to be moderate or severe, or symptoms that tend to persist over time or get progressively worse over time, a lot of times can be indicative of more of an underlying kind of medical problem. So those kind of cases, I think, usually require further evaluation by a physician.
So you had mentioned GERD. What is the difference between acid reflux and GERD?
Sure. So they're very similar. They're kind of the same thing. The main difference is in terms of how long the symptoms are going on and how problematic they are. So with acid reflux, you have the fundamental issue with acid reflux is gastric acid travels backwards into the esophagus and it burns the lining of the esophagus, which can cause the classic sensation of heartburn, where people get that kind of burning sensation in the middle of their chest. It is somewhat normal to occasionally get heartburn. So if you get heartburn occasionally, a couple times, let's say a month or something like that, it's usually not a big deal. In patients who have persistent acid reflux multiple times a week or multiple times a day or with every single meal, then that's particularly problematic. And that's usually when we term it gastroesophageal reflux disease.
And why is it important to get that treated? Aside from the discomfort, which is
sure,
just...
sure. So two main reasons. So one is because of the symptoms, like you mentioned. So obviously having symptoms of burning in your chest or acid regurgitation, which happens when stomach acid travels all the way up to your mouth and you can actually taste acid in your mouth. So those symptoms themselves can be problematic. So that's one reason you would want to treat GERD. But the other reason to treat it would be to prevent complications of GERD. So long-standing acid reflux damage to the esophagus can result in scar tissue formation, and that scar tissue in the esophagus can sometimes form strictures. And those strictures oftentimes can cause issues with food getting stuck when people swallow, so patients oftentimes will develop swallowing difficulties as a result of that. So that's one of the complications uncontrolled GERD can cause. The other thing long-standing GERD can result in is the development of something called Barrett's esophagus. Barrett's esophagus refers to a change in the lining of the esophagus. In an attempt to try to make the esophagus a little bit more robust against the damages of acid from the stomach. But the problem with Barrett's esophagus is the lining is abnormal and it is at an increased risk of developing into kind of a precancerous lining or eventually developing into cancer of the esophagus as well, which of course is much more problematic.
What actually causes GERD? Are there certain people at higher risk?
There are certain people at higher risk. So there's a few different risk factors for GERD. Probably two of the more common ones are people who are overweight or obese, mm-hmm. Just having increased tissue in your abdomen increases the pressure on your stomach and can result in increased episodes of reflux. And then the other thing is people who have a hiatal hernia are at an increased risk of GERD. A hiatal hernia being when part of your stomach is up in your chest, and that can also result in increases in acid reflux. As to the cause of acid reflux itself, usually it occurs when there's a weakness in a muscle at the bottom of the esophagus. So normally your esophagus has a muscle at the bottom that separates the esophagus and the stomach, and that muscle normally stays closed to prevent stomach contents from traveling backwards into the esophagus. And normally, of course, when you eat something, that muscle opens up to let food pass into your stomach. In people who have GERD, a lot of times that muscle is weak and or loose, and that results in an inability to keep stomach contents in the stomach and allows for stomach contents, specifically acid in this case, to move back into the esophagus and damage the lining of the esophagus, resulting in GERD.
How exactly is GERD diagnosed? Because aside from someone just reporting, I'm having repeated acid reflux, are there actual diagnostic tests?
There are diagnostic tests. GERD is typically diagnosed clinically by a physician. So if you see your doctor and based on the description of your symptoms, they could usually make the diagnosis of GERD just by symptom alone. Testing isn't necessarily required. However, in cases where the diagnosis is uncertain, or if you want it to be absolutely sure that the diagnosis is in fact GERD, there is testing that can be done to confirm the diagnosis. That oftentimes involves either doing an upper endoscopy and sometimes doing more specific testing called esophageal pH testing, which involves placing a probe with sensors in the esophagus that is there to detect any episodes of acid reflux and can confirm whether patients do in fact actually have acid reflux or not.
So once someone has a diagnosis, what are the most effective treatment options for managing GERD?
So there's a couple different treatment options. The mainstay of treatment would involve lifestyle modifications as well as medications to treat the symptoms. So typical, kind of your more common changes you could make in your lifestyle would include avoiding trigger foods. So certain foods are known to tend to make reflux worse. A lot of times those would include things like acidic foods, spicy foods, sometimes tomato sauce or tomato-based foods can do it. Alcohol is another thing that can make acid reflux worse. So avoiding trigger foods, not eating 2 to 3 hours before bedtime, sleeping with the head of your bed elevated, which can prevent or minimize the chances of reflux from the stomach into the esophagus. And in patients who are overweight or obese, losing weight can help as well. So those are some of the lifestyle things you could do. And then medication-wise, the main medicine we use is a class of medicine called proton pump inhibitors, or PPIs, which help with symptom relief. They work by decreasing the acidity of the stomach, meaning making the stomach acid less acidic. So it doesn't get rid of reflux. Reflux still happens, but because the stomach acid is not quite as acidic, you don't get that sensation of burning as you would if you were not on medication. So those are the usual treatments. In certain patients with more severe cases, sometimes endoscopy or surgery may be necessary to fix kind of that muscle and tighten it to prevent reflux episodes.
All right. Well, something we also hear a lot about is irritable bowel syndrome. What exactly is it and how is it diagnosed?
Right. So irritable bowel syndrome is a functional kind of gastrointestinal disorder, meaning that it's a disorder of brain-gut interaction. And it occurs when the nerves that control your gastrointestinal tract are hypersensitive. And there's various kind of stimuli that can cause these nerves to become overactive, and overactive nerves can result in gastrointestinal symptoms. In the case of IBS, it's typically crampy abdominal pain and changes in your bowel habits, which can include issues like loose stools, diarrhea in some patients. Some patients get predominantly constipation, and some patients have kind of alternating issues where they'll have diarrhea and constipation kind of on an alternating basis. But there's nothing actually wrong with the gastrointestinal tract itself in irritable bowel syndrome. And that's why a lot of times when we do testing, all the testing comes back normal, because it's more of a nerve issue rather than a gastrointestinal problem.
How is IBS typically managed and treated?
So somewhat similar to GERD, there's certain lifestyle modifications you can make to manage IBS, and there are medications you could use to help control your symptoms. IBS is a lifelong condition, so there's no one medicine necessarily that we could give to cure it or get rid of it. But the main kind of medicines we use for IBS would be for controlling your symptoms. So there's medicines we could give for patients who have mostly abdominal cramping or pain, patients who have issues with their bowels, diarrhea, constipation. There's medicines we could give to help kind of alleviate those as well. And then from a non-medical standpoint, kind of lifestyle things that can be done, avoiding certain kind of foods that sometimes can trigger symptoms. A lot of times that can include kind of gas-producing foods, beans, cabbage. In some people, gluten or lactose can also kind of tend to make your symptoms worse. So avoiding those kind of foods would be a big thing that that patients can do to help kind of minimize some of their symptoms. And then the other thing is there's IBS a lot of times is worsened under periods of stress, both physical stress as well as emotional or psychological stress. So controlling kind of stressors in your life is the other thing that that a lot of times is helpful in controlling IBS symptoms as well.
It's important to distinguish IBS from IBD or inflammatory bowel disease. So what exactly is IBD?
Right. So, yes, so absolutely. They're two completely different conditions. So IBD, or inflammatory bowel disease, is a condition where there's inflammation that it can occur in your gastrointestinal tract. So usually it occurs as a result of an overactive immune system that targets the body's own normal tissue in the gastrointestinal tract and results in inflammation. And in IBD, that inflammation a lot of times can result in abdominal pain and can result in issues with bloody stools as well. So some of the symptoms, namely the abdominal pain, can be similar to IBS, but it's a completely different kind of disease process.
So some of the most common, Crohn's, ulcerative colitis, let's talk about each. What is Crohn's disease?
Sure. So both of those, so inflammatory bowel disease is kind of the broad category, and both the two specific subtypes would be Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis, like you mentioned. So in Crohn's disease, there's inflammation that can happen anywhere in the gastrointestinal tract, from the top in the esophagus, the food pipe, all the way down into the colon. And it may involve multiple segments of the gastrointestinal tract. Most commonly, Crohn's disease affects the small intestine, but like I said, it can affect kind of any part of the gastrointestinal tract. And the symptoms are kind of like the general symptoms of inflammatory bowel disease, abdominal pain. Bloody stools are possible, although a little bit less likely in Crohn's disease than they are in ulcerative colitis. But issues with loose stools and diarrhea a lot of times are more common in patients who have Crohn's disease.
You mentioned some of the differentiating factors, but how does that differ totally from ulcerative colitis? What is that?
Sure. So ulcerative colitis is limited to just the colon for the most part. Whereas, like I mentioned, Crohn's disease can involve kind of any segment of the gastrointestinal tract. Ulcerative colitis more commonly causes bloody stools than Crohn's disease does. But it has a more limited local extent, as opposed to Crohn's disease. But a lot of the symptoms are somewhat similar, and treatment options are fairly similar between the both of them as well.
So how do doctors go about differentiating between Crohn's and ulcerative colitis, aside from where it's located? Or is
right.
it pretty much the same?
Well, so the location makes a big difference, right. Because if the disease is just limited to the colon, ulcerative colitis is much more likely. Of course, if you have disease present in other areas, then Crohn's disease is usually the likely culprit. But differentiating between the two of them, it's a combination of symptoms and testing. Testing usually including imaging of the abdomen. Sometimes stool testing can help. And then a lot of times doing endoscopy, colonoscopy with biopsies can also kind of help determine the location of the disease and can also help differentiate between the two sometimes.
What are the risk factors for IBD?
So IBD there is a genetic or hereditary component to it. So a lot of times patients with a strong family history of inflammatory bowel disease are more susceptible to developing it themselves, although that's not necessarily always the case. IBD can also just arise sporadically. And it's believed that patients who are susceptible to the disease, like I said, they don't always develop it, but sometimes based on certain kind of environmental exposures through life, they can go on to develop the disease because of that.
Is there an age where it's most commonly developed or when
Sure. A lot of times it's more common in younger adults, those kind of late teens, early 20s, 30s even. But it can arise at any age, children as well as later on in life as well.
Can you talk about some of the advancements in treating IBD?
Yeah, of course. So IBD classically used to be treated, there was more limited treatment options for it in the past. A lot of the medications we used to use previously were, there was a few different kind of oral medications, pills, and steroids such as prednisone. But over the last however many years, biologic therapy has kind of become the mainstay of treatment for inflammatory bowel disease, particularly in patients who have kind of more moderate or severe symptoms. Biologic therapy usually involves either injections, which patients can learn to administer themselves, or infusions that they could get at an infusion center. And these treatments a lot of times are spaced out, so they're not necessarily everyday treatments like a pill would be, but they're done every so many weeks or so. But that's kind of some of the biggest advancements. There's been a lot of biologics that have come out, and there's always new ones coming out as well. So there's a lot of new kind of treatment options for IBD that gives us a lot of therapeutic options in individuals.
Why is it so important to get IBD diagnosed and appropriately manage it?
First and foremost, to control any kind of symptoms patients are having, of course. So if they're having issues with abdominal pain and bloody stools, of course, that's something that they don't want to live with forever. So that would be the main reason to initiate treatment. But the other reason would be to prevent complications developing from inflammatory bowel disease. So individuals who have uncontrolled inflammatory bowel disease can develop anemia from chronic gastrointestinal bleeding. They can also develop issues with bowel obstructions or issues with gastrointestinal fistulas. And then the other complication that they could develop is colorectal cancer. So all those things are complications of uncontrolled disease. So controlling the disease early, in addition to improving symptoms and your quality of life, also greatly reduces the chances of developing complications down the road that can make things a lot more challenging for you.
So we just discussed a few of the most common issues, but are there common myths or misconceptions about GI health overall that you hear from a lot of your patients and you try to clear up with them?
Personally, I don't think there's any common one I hear all the time, any kind of myth or misconception. One thing I do always tell people is just be careful of what you read on the internet. There's a lot of good information on the internet, but there's a lot of faulty information out there too. And sometimes it's difficult to distinguish between the two. So if you do have any kind of gastrointestinal problems or any kind of health problems in for that matter, I do think it's important to see a doctor in the office, make sure you're able to talk about your concerns and have them addressed appropriately.
Absolutely. What advice do you provide for people who are struggling with digestive issues but haven't seen a specialist yet, other than go see one?
Sure. In my opinion, the cornerstone of good health is based on diet and exercise and living a healthy lifestyle. So a diet rich in protein, fruits and vegetables, and low in kind of processed foods, fried foods, junk foods is very beneficial, as well as regular exercise, combining both kind of cardiovascular aerobic exercise as well as weightlifting or resistance training for muscle growth are important. So I think that's something that everyone should do just to maintain good health. In terms of patients who have specific kind of gastrointestinal issues that need addressed, first and foremost, I guess I would encourage them to see their primary care physician first. A lot of the more common gastrointestinal ailments can be addressed perfectly fine by primary care physicians. They could do a thorough kind of initial evaluation, order appropriate testing, and start treatment if necessary. And at the same time, they can help you determine if, based on your particular case, if your symptoms are more complicated or just kind of more involved, they could help you figure out when it's time to see a specialist to get their additional kind of expertise.
And of course, it's just so important to get it treated and get it treated early so you don't end up with one of these more terrible complications you mentioned.
I completely agree. I think not just in gastroenterology, but in a lot of things in medicine, treating disease early and making sure it's under control is important for improving your quality of life, alleviating any symptoms the disease is causing, and ideally preventing complications down the road. A lot of diseases may seem mild initially, but if they go uncontrolled, they can cause significant problems down the road. And of course, in medicine, the goal, the main goal is always to try to keep people healthy, prevent them from developing disease, but in those who already have disease, controlling that disease so it doesn't cause further problems down the road.
Definitely. Dr. Radatich, thank you so much for joining us.
Of course, thank you.
If you liked this episode of HealthCasts, please like and comment, and visit smh.com/podcast to listen to more experts talking about health issues which matter to you. As always, we encourage everyone in our community to visit smh.com to get the latest from Sarasota Memorial. Have a great day.